This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. For close to 20 years, Kathy and Bruce Harrison have been foster parents. They have cared for more than 120 children, including a little girl named Daisy. Kathy Harrison tells Daisy's story in One Small Boat, the story of a little girl lost, then found. Why did she write about Daisy? Well, one of the reasons. She hopes we'll see the real children hiding within the statistics. There are more than 500,000 children in the child welfare system in the United States. When Daisy came to the Harrisons, she was 6 years old. Here's how the social services worker described Daisy when she called Kathy on a Friday afternoon. Only six, but two prior psych hospitalizations. Anorexic, aggressive toward her mother, very little speech, maybe retarded, very depressed. She's on a ton of medication. Kathy Harrison and her husband Bruce were named Massachusetts Foster Parents of the Year in 1996. In 2002, they were honored with the Goldie Rogers Award. Kathy Harrison is a member of the board of the National Foster Parent Association and the Massachusetts Foster Parent Association. In addition to One Small Boat, the story of a little girl lost then found, Kathy Harrison is the author of Another Place at the Table. Kathy Harrison, welcome. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. It's so good to talk with you. We're going to talk a good deal about the difficulties, the challenges of being a foster parent this afternoon. But before we do that, maybe you should talk about why you do it.
Oh, there are some days when I wonder. You know, I never planned to be a foster parent. This was not something in my life picture. I was teaching in a preschool for at-risk children, and I think that I had the same mindset that any number of other people do. When you think of a number like 500,000 children, you lose sight of the reality that these are real children, that they're not just statistics. And I never thought of them as real children. But while I was teaching, I met a little girl who was five and really challenging, living in a foster home. At the end of the school year, I got a call from her therapist saying that they were thinking about a psychiatric hospitalization for her. Her behavior was really becoming more and more challenging, and the foster home that she was in had refused to keep her another second. And I decided that my husband and I might, in fact, be able to do this. We talked about it briefly, and when I say briefly, I mean about 10 minutes, and realized that we could not say no to this little girl who I had grown quite fond of. And then I discovered that she had a sister, and I could not see separating the siblings. I had three sons, and I couldn't imagine my boys being separated. So my husband went to work that day, a father of three, and came home a father of five. But still, foster parenting was not how I identified myself. However, with a license to provide foster care, we took the training and got the license, and several empty bedrooms, the phone started to ring. And I began to hear the stories of the real children behind the statistics of 500,000. And while I found it easy to say no to the idea of another child, you know, the general mm-hmm. picture of another child, I found it very hard to say no to Maggie, who is six and has been sexually abused, and she's sitting in the waiting room, and we can't find a family for her. That I found I couldn't do. Even then, even when I began to take kids and I looked around one day and said, oh, my God, we've got eight children. How did this happen? I was reluctant to identify myself as a foster parent because the press on us was so bad. I was a little embarrassed. And only as I did the work did I come to realize how really important it was, what an impact we could have in a kid's life. And I began to identify myself as a foster parent before I identified myself as a teacher or a writer or any of the other things that I did. I realized that that had become who I, in fact, was.
Yeah. When those first children arrived at your door, what was it like?
Well, you know, for the first two girls, it was easier. I had three older sons. They were younger children. They were minority children. So there was this whole cultural piece that I had to come to terms with in a very, very white community. And I was surprised at how absolutely terrified I was. I was aware that I could make a mistake that could be catastrophic. And every time a kid walks in the door, the dynamic of the family then changes.
Mm-hmm.
Your whole family changes because of the addition of this other person. And that took some getting used to. We are better at it now, but I will confess that even now, if I've said I will take a child, I always have this moment before they arrive when I think, how arrogant of me. I can't do this. This is going to be far too much. And of course, the crazy moment passes, and I, in fact, do it and can do it. And usually enjoy doing it to a certain extent, at least. It is a different kind of a life.
Oh. You write in One Small Boat that every new arrival of a child changes the dynamics of the family.
Yeah.
And to quote you, not always for the better. Love, you say, is not always enough to change the outcome for a child.
Very true. When I talk about changing the dynamics, depending on the age of the child I take, my baby may no longer be the baby. My oldest child may no longer have that role in the family. There are children who come in who speak to you right away. They feel very comfortable and at home. There are other children, it is really a challenge to deal with, kids who are angry and aggressive or depressed and withdrawn or sullen. And it means that everyone sort of we have to circle the wagons around this child for a while, until we figure out who they are, what they need, what can we provide. And this is a truth about foster parenting that I think everyone should understand. Foster parenting is somewhat like being, I would think, in the prison system, because it will bring out either the absolute best in a family or it will bring out the worst. These children are used to being victims. And it is so important to understand that it can bring out the worst. It can bring out the worst in your children. It can bring out this sense of entitlement of being somewhat better than. And Bruce and I had to really be on our guard all the time that our children are all treated with respect and dignity, afforded dignity.
Yeah. When do you say, I'm not up to this particular child?
I say it more often than I used to. I'm usually willing to give anything a try, and one of the things that Daisy, the child I wrote about in One Small Boat, really taught me is that the child on paper is not necessarily the child in reality, and that it is too soon for a child who is 6 or 7 or 10 to write them off, and that every child deserves at least a shot. So we will often give a shot. When I say too much is if I think a child puts my other children at risk. I can't have a child who is a sexual perpetrator. I've had any number of them who were, and it is simply not safe, given that so many of my other children are so fragile and so vulnerable. I don't want to put them in the position of having to protect themselves because I have to take a shower from time to time. So I would say no to that. We have adopted recently a little girl with serious special needs. She has Cornelia de Lange syndrome, so lots of medical needs. And I would be hesitant to take another child whose medical condition needed the kind of time and attention that our Phoebe needs, because you know what? You can only stretch yourself so far.
Hmm.
So for every family, it's different.
Hmm.
And we also make the decision based on, you know, where we are at any given point. Moment in our lives, there are times when we say, boy, we've really got some extra energy and we could take on a real challenge right now. Other times when we say, you know what, Karen's looking really fragile, Phoebe's looking pretty fragile, we really can't do anything else right now.
Yeah. Now, at the point when you accepted Daisy, you and your husband, Bruce, had talked about, you know, taking a bit of a break.
Yeah, we talked about that often.
And he said, you know, come on, Kathy, no babies right now, or no children with very serious problems. But that first night with Daisy, he was in her corner big time.
He really was.
Yeah. So why couldn't you, the two of you, say no to Daisy?
I think I heard that story. I heard her history. And there were two other children presented at about the same time, and I knew those other two would have an easy time finding a family, maybe someone without as much experience because they weren't going to require a lot of experience. But I heard Daisy's story, and I knew that not just anybody was going to be able to take care of her. And we had, at that point, had a lot of experience, especially around some of her issues. I've had several kids with eating disorders, and I'd had several kids who were retarded. I'd had several kids who looked autistic and several kids who'd been in psychiatric hospitals. And I really thought we were, in fact, her best shot. I also wasn't concerned, after hearing the history, and here's so much for plans, I was not concerned about falling in love with this kid. We had just adopted our daughter, Karen, and, a year or so earlier, and she was going through some stuff. She was that year diagnosed with Tourette syndrome. And I wasn't concerned. I thought, this kid is going to be so difficult. Falling in love with her would not be a problem. Well, guess what?
Yeah.
I sometimes think that the children that we tend to fall in love with are rarely the prettiest, they're rarely the smartest, they are rarely the best behaved or the most typical. They are often the quirkiest, the most demanding, because those are the children you've poured your heart and soul into. And certainly we very quickly found ourselves just head over heels in love with this kid.
Yeah. Now, if you hadn't been there that Friday afternoon and picked up the phone, what in all likelihood might have happened to Daisy?
I would love to think that another family would have simply done it and found what we found. The reality is, if they couldn't have found a family, she would have gone to a home that just took her on hotline, meaning the plan was only to keep her for a couple of days. And she would have ended up in a specialized foster home where they only do one child, but a child with severe special needs. Or she might have ended up in a hospital again, which would have been a tragedy.
Yeah, it is so hard for me to wrap my mind around a six-year-old with two psychiatric hospitalizations.
It is hard to fathom. In my previous book, in Another Place at the Table, I talked about my first experience bringing a six-year-old to a psychiatric hospital. And this was a child who had been sexually abused, multiple perpetrators, over the course of her entire life. She told a therapist once that until she had moved with us, no one had ever been kind to her a day in her life, and I believe that to have been true. I had every reason to believe that that was true. And when I walked in, I was struck, first of all, by how remarkably ugly it was, institutional and cold. The staff was lovely and caring, but the place itself felt awful. And it was so horrible for me to realize that this child would have been safe nowhere else. She was hurting herself. She was hurting other children. A real threat to society. And it is also sad for me to realize that she never came out of that hospital. I mean, she's in different places, but she has remained institutionalized her whole life, and may well spend her life in an institution because she is so seriously damaged. And I think that it is easier not to wrap your mind around it. It is easier to forget that these children are out there, but these children are out there. And oftentimes they are there not because their biology is bad, but because their history is awful. And I think, what if we declared war against child abuse? Wouldn't that change the reality for so many children? I think we could do that. Mm-hmm. I don't think we will do that, but I think we could do that.
Kathy Harrison is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author most recently of One Small Boat, the story of a little girl lost, then found. For close to 20 years now, Kathy and her husband Bruce have been foster parents. And this book, One Small Boat, tells the story of a little girl named Daisy. And Kathy Harrison writes in this book, why did she write about Daisy? She hopes we'll see the real kids hiding within the statistic. More than 500,000 children in the child welfare system in the U.S. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. A listener in Hayworth on a cell phone, line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Celeste. Thanks for taking my call. Fascinating topic. My wife and I have two small children, and our days are too full. So my hat's off to your guest. I can't imagine that responsibility. It's a fascinating topic. I had no idea that we were talking about 500,000 children. That just seems unbelievable. And I was wondering if your guest could speak. I was just curious as to the statistics. with foster children. How often do they stay in a foster home before they're selected by a family? The majority of them, do they come into the foster system because their parents are neglectful or because they passed away? And do you find, again, statistically, we're talking about more female than male children, or more children of color? I'm just interested in the numbers as to how people actually end up in the system. And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thanks.
Okay. You know, he hit upon many of the myths of foster care. And one of the first myths is that these are orphans, that they have no families. Absolutely not true. In all the years I've done foster care, I have never had a child who didn't, in fact, have a family. The second myth is that children come in and are immediately placed on an adoption track. The majority of our children will, in fact, go home again. Now, I can tell you the Massachusetts statistics, and I suspect that they carry across the country, but every day, in Massachusetts, it's a fairly small state, 20 children, 25, come into care. One-fifth of those children will never go home again. Another fifth, I believe it is, will go home, but they will be returned to the foster care system at some point in their life. Now, of the ones who don't go home again, the Adoption and Safe Families Act had made a real effort to address kids who just stayed in foster care for 5, 6, 7 years. And the law now is that at 6 months you have a review and determine whether or not the parents are making adequate steps to get their children returned to them. And if they're not, we're looking at going on to the adoption track in that next 6 month period. Now, that sounds very pleasant, doesn't it? But the reality is that our children are not always kids that a lot of people are lining up to take. These are rarely healthy infants. These are often sibling groups, 2 or 3, 4 kids. They're often children of color. They are often children with some special needs. They are often children with profound loss in their life and profound abuse and neglect. And their histories mean that they're going to struggle throughout their life, often kids with some academic problems or schooling may have been interrupted often. So that's one piece of this as to how they come. Kids are not removed from their homes because their parents have spanked them too hard once. They're not removed because, you know, they came home from school to an empty house one day. I get children with venereal disease. I get children with cigarette burns and broken bones. These children often have got profound abuse in their background, a lot of sexual abuse. I think that the statistic I saw at one point was like 60% to 70% of these of adolescent girls in care can look back and acknowledge some sexual abuse in their history. The boy and girl piece, I don't know what the dynamic is there, how what the demographics are. As far as children of color, the overwhelming majority of children in care are white, actually. So children come into care for, you know, a variety of things. Drug and alcohol abuse in the parents is a huge problem, as are mental health issues. We had the Reagan administration had passed laws about deinstitutionalization and another lofty goal. Let's empty our institutions. These are such hideous, awful places, which indeed they were. Unfortunately, no one made a plan for what we would do with those people when they came out of institutions. And a number of them, an astonishing number of them, had children. And of course, they could not care for it all. So these kids were coming into care with biology against them. Their parents were mentally ill, and there are certainly some genetic components to that. And also then neglect and abuse because they had inadequate caregivers. So we're certainly seeing the results of that, and actually we're seeing the second generation of that now. The children have now had children. We are also seeing a lot of kids coming whose mothers were 14 and 15, and it seemed like such a lovely idea at the time to raise a baby, and then the reality hit, and raising a baby is really hard work and not something that the majority of 14-year-olds are really capable of. So across the boards, I would also have to say that the children who come to me can be newborns, and they can be 17. They can be the brightest kid in the class. They can have severe special needs. They can. I've had kids in wheelchairs, and I have had the star of the soccer team. I've had the dearest, sweetest, loveliest children in the world, and I've had children who would make you fear for people who had to live with them. In short, the children who come to me are just like everybody else's kids. They are everybody's kids. And the people that we need to take care of them, by definition then, whoever you are in the world, there's a child out there who has what you need, who needs what you have to offer, assuming that your motives are honorable, assuming that you're, you know, an empathetic and kind person and not a child abuser. There's somebody out there who needs what you have to offer.
I don't know if I'd be up to it, Kathy.
Not everybody is. There are other ways, I think, to be involved in the life of kids, and there are adolescents who could use a mentor who don't necessarily want a parent, but could certainly use someone who walked them into adulthood, holding their hand. And it isn't for everybody. But I hope that one of the things people will think about, you know, there are a lot of problems with the foster care system, and one of the things that comes up often is that numbers, we have too many children. And that, in fact, is true, but the math says kids cannot sleep in offices. They have to be placed somewhere. And when the beds are full, then you take more kids than you really ought to have. So other people do need to step up. But maybe even if you're not in a position to take four kids, could you take one child? Could you take an older child who perhaps didn't need the intense parenting that a three-year-old might need? Lots of different ways to help. Could you volunteer some time for the CASA program, the court-appointed special advocacy? Or there are several mentoring programs. There are ways to help.
Yeah.
Can you pick up when you're shopping an extra toothbrush, shampoo, underwear, socks, pajamas, and donate it to your local social service agency so that when a child comes into care, maybe they could come with a backpack and a few things that belong to them. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
And we have lots of people in Massachusetts who do that for us.
Hmm. Well, coming up later this afternoon, May 10th, 2006, I'm going to talk with the executive director of our Champaign County CASA, County Court appointed special advocates, Genevieve Lambert, and we'll talk with her this afternoon about what kind of opportunities there are in that program for volunteers who advocate for the interests of abused and neglected children. So.
It's such an important thing, I think, that we are a society that although we would claim to love children, we really do put the needs and the rights of adults ahead of them very often. And a program like CASA, it ensures that children are heard in a very meaningful way. I admire their work so much.
Yeah. It's very important to listen to these children. I was really moved by how you listen to Daisy, how you listen to Jazzy. It's important to hear what they have to say.
I am by nature a talker, and I've really had to learn that in the stillness and silence, children can, in fact, share with you what they're thinking. And they may not share it in language that you might readily understand. They may share it in a behavior. They may share it in a picture. But they will share that inner life with you. I am moved sometimes to watch children. I have a very large wooden dollhouse with tons of people and furniture. And so often, children will play out a scene in the dollhouse that I know is from their own history. And you have to be able to sit silently and listen to what it is they're trying to tell you.
Yeah, Daisy did that first day with you.
She did. She did. And in so many ways, it was her drawing. And I have to, you know, I wonder sometimes about my intrusion into the lives of children because they're entitled to some privacy. On the other hand, I have to give them the space to know that it is okay to tell me that I am not going to cry, which is certainly my first inclination. I'm a crier by nature, and I've really had to learn how to swallow that back because children can't afford to think that they need to take care of me. That's not their job. They have to know that I'm not going to get angry. It is not acceptable for me to say, oh, I'd like to kill someone who did that. That's too much responsibility for a child. What I need to say is just, that sounds really scary, and it sounds like it wasn't okay, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to make sure that doesn't happen again. And that's all kids really need to hear, that I heard what you said, I absolutely believe you, and I will do what I can to keep you safe.
Yeah. There's a a scene in the story where Daisy's mother and grandmother have come for a visit, their first visit since Daisy had come to your home. And Daisy got very, she just collapsed in a sense.
The anxiety was just too much for her.
And you just took her aside and you said, I need you to stop.
Yeah.
And you said, can you do that? Or
do you need me to help?
Yeah, do you need me to help?
Mm-hmm. I think that often what our children need, and I use this so often, is to be scooped up and have your arms wrapped really tightly around them. Because I think when they're that anxious, they disorganize internally. And, you know, you think about your drawers in a jumble or your cupboards, that's what their emotions feel like. In their body, I mean, physically, I think they feel like that jumble, in the sense of someone's arms around them can organize them again. And I can feel children, although they might fight against that initially, sort of melt, and then they're able to calm down. I often will do that. And it's interesting because I think that there are people who would say that that was not okay, that it was too much hands-on. And I think kids need hands-on. I think that their little bodies and their souls cry out for adults to touch them physically in a way that is calming.
Yeah. At the same time, though, I think you're acutely aware of, you know, when to push and when to back away and when there should be breathing room. Daisy had great difficulty with food. And you knew from the outset you could make that worse if you pushed her. Mm-hmm. You also knew you could make it worse if you caved.
You
also knew she had to eat something.
Exactly. And there were many nights that one of the things she couldn't tolerate was juice of any sort, just truly made her nauseous. And I asked her at one point, so, sweetie, is it the flavor that you don't like? Is it the temperature? Is it the texture? And she was able to say, it feels funny in my mouth. So we started taking straws, like cocktail straws, the little ones, and putting them in a drink. And so you'd pull up, you know, a quarter of an inch. I mean, it was drops, literally, and dropping it on her tongue bit by bit by bit to desensitize her to the taste and the texture. And, in fact, we started out, it wasn't even whole apple juice. It was apple juice and water mixed. And then increased it until it was pure apple juice. And then used a bigger straw. And then used a sippy cup. And it took weeks and weeks of this before she could actually swallow juice. It was like that for most things. There were things that she never, in fact, learned to eat. I don't think I ever saw her eat a bean. There was something about that texture that was absolutely unbearable to her. But many things she did learn. However, it meant sitting at the table with her next to me and rubbing her back during the meal, or, you know, holding her other hand and giving it a little squeeze from time to time. But you couldn't treat this as a bad behavior. This was not about a kid who was recalcitrant or difficult or negative or oppositional. This was about a kid who was in total distress. I can only think of it in terms of if someone served me a plate of, you know, eyeballs, which I suppose that there are places in the world that there are eyeballs of something that they consume, think how horrible that would be. That's how she felt about eating.
Yeah. I've got another listener waiting to talk with us, but before I go to the listener in Savoy, who I hope will hold with me here just a moment more, another thing that was very interesting to think about is Jasmine, she screamed. She had tantrums, and you can't yell at her.
Nope.
And so you take it, and
you have no choices.
Yep. And but the thing is that by hearing her out, you begin to build trust with that child.
You do, and I almost had to go with it. It was sort of a Zen thing. But I will confess that there were many, many, many nights I had a friend who has been through all this stuff. She's a foster parent, too. And I called her. I will vividly remember it must have been 10:30 at night. Who calls anybody at 10:30 at night? And I said, you have got to talk to me. If you do not talk to me, I am going to kill her. She has been screaming for an hour and a half. I can't listen another minute. And she so sweetly just sat and talked. We talked about books and gardens. And in about 10 minutes, I said, thank you, I'm much better, and I will go deal again. It was hard, hard work. But you had to see beyond the scream. Once again, this is a child who was three. She could not say to me, I feel miserable. I'm angry and sad, and I have these memories that are terrifying to me, and I'm not sure I can trust you. She told me with her behavior day after day after day. The people that adopted her, I still talk to them often. And I would love to say that, oh, it ended in 3 months or 4 months. It was years before she really could calm down and say, here's what's going on, here's how I feel. Years. Those people had the patience of a saint.
Let's talk with a listener in Savoy now, line one. Hi.
Hello. I wanted to thank WILL for having this program and mention that May is Foster Parent Appreciation Month, at least here in Illinois. So
across the country.
Okay, well, yeah, so this is your month. Thank you. I just want to say I have an opportunity to work with a lot of foster parents in my job, and I just wanted to say that I find that, you know, overall that they are very heroic people and very much people who are giving of themselves, as, you know, as you're describing. And I just really like the idea that that the word is, you know, getting out and get some very positive publicity for them, because I think sometimes they do get kind of a negative rap in the media and so forth. So,
well, it's absolutely true. I think that the statistic that the last one I heard was that only 2% of foster parents are ever convicted of abusing a kid. The other 98%, so that there are 142,000 foster parents in this country who get up every day and put their feet on the floor and decide to do the work yet again. You will never hear about them because, quite honestly, we're not all that interesting. You know, a lot of what we do is the stuff of every parent. We wash a lot of faces and a lot of dishes and a lot of diapers and a lot of floors. I do think I spend half my life cleaning things. And we have very few big hurrahs. Our rewards are largely personal and small. I was thinking the other day about a kid that I'd had in care for a long time, about a year. Challenging little kid, just sort of negative and oppositional, not awful, but challenging. And I, at the end of the year, I was thinking, have I made any difference in this child's life at all? Because she doesn't really look all that different to me. I was watching the kids play soccer out in the backyard, and our youngest daughter, I'd mentioned, has serious special needs, was out there sort of toddling around behind everybody, and she fell. And this little girl, you know, stopped in her running and sort of turned around and scooped my Phoebe up and dusted off her bottom and took her hand and then ran with her, quick kicking the ball. And it was such a kind and empathetic and normal, typical response from a kid. And I thought, okay, those are the moments that I do it for. It is not a big hurrah, and I'm sure many people would hear that and say, well, yeah, my kid does that all the time. This was not a kind child prior to this. It's a very small reward, but it was major to me. And across the country, there are 140,000 people who do exactly what I do, who just, I don't know, maybe get more sleep than I do and didn't write a book about it.
Well,
but they're doing exactly what I do every day.
Well, I find that foster parents that I know are very, oftentimes very flexible people who know how to make, you know, situations that are uncertain just work out day to day, and it's always a marvelous thing to see. So thank you again.
Well, thank you. And flexible, yes, that would describe us. We better be.
And on that note, I want to share something from One Small Boat, and that is when you learned your daughter, Karen, had Tourette's syndrome. And you write at the end of that chapter, here's the truth of it. You don't get to pick.
You don't. Nobody ever asked. I've had so many people say, how could you stand it? How did you manage? Didn't have a choice. Nobody said, or you could do something else. This was my daughter, and so we had to figure out how to do it.
And at the end, yeah, and then at the end of this chapter, the very end, you say, you used the lessons you learned from the children like Daisy.
Yes, absolutely. That you can have really horrible things in your life, but if you can get up in the morning and make a conscious choice not to let it define you, but to love again. And that's what I decided. I could let this be a tragedy that defined me, or I could use it as a stepping stone. And I had to make sure that I didn't let Karen see it as a defining tragedy in my life, because then it would become one in hers. Mm. What small child wants to be responsible for her mother's grief? And I have to say, she's now 12, and she absolutely has Tourette's, and she's a pretty ticky little kid, and she has obsessive-compulsive disorder, and she is bipolar. And you know what? She's still happy more days than she's sad, and she is a joy to us every day. She's funny and quirky and charming, and it was okay.
Hmm. Your three boys, are they grown now?
They are all grown. My oldest son is 30, and he is a computer whiz kid, and I don't know, designs things that I don't understand at all. We simply say, oh, yes, he designs computer spyware program or something. My son Nathan is 28, and he is a counselor for disturbed adolescent boys, has been working in the same program, married to a woman who is a director of a mental health agency for children. And my son Ben did 2 years of missionary service and then worked at Camp to Belong, which is a camp Lynn Price started several years ago that reunites siblings separated by foster care and adoption. Hugely important, so many of our kids are separated. And he fell in love with the social service system and now is back in school to be a social worker.
Hmm.
My other two daughters, Angie was the first little girl we adopted. She is now 21 in finding herself, but thinking that therapy. She's really interested in child psychology. And my daughter Nettie's goal in life, she is an accountant, but her goal in life is to someday provide foster care for parenting teens. Pregnant and parenting teens feels like that's, you know, such a calling for her. So I think all of the kids, you know, have some sort of a social service bent, with the exception of my oldest, who's just one of those computer people, but he also is a loving and kind father. And I think that over the years, there were some losses for them.
Mm-hmm.
There were times I was less available than I should have been. Certainly times they lived with absolute chaos with some of our children. Certainly times when they were pained by the loss of children that they had come to think of as brothers and sisters. But overall, I think they gained more than they lost. They have a much broader perspective of the world than many kids do. They have an amazing work ethic. And I have to say that all of my kids know how to cook a meal, change a diaper, toss in a load of laundry, because they had to know those things.
And you and your husband, the two of you have made tremendous sacrifices. And there are stresses and strains.
There sure are. There are stresses around things. Bruce and I have had a couple of instances, not many, but a few, where children needed permanency, and one of us would have been willing to do an adoption and the other not. And those were hard times for us, but we have always been really clear that it took two yeses and one no to make an adoption happen. So that was definite. We also had to figure, and it took us a while to get to this place, we had to figure out a way to find a space to be a couple, because for a while we were consumed with only being parents, and a couple can't survive being only parents. So we make sure we've got a Thursday night date night, and the kids know. Now, I don't admit this to everybody, so I think I'll just admit it on, you know, national radio here, that every Thursday night, without exception, it has to be something pretty dramatic for us not to be there. We watch Survivor together. Now, my kids think this is so hysterically funny because we rarely ever watch TV, and the idea of reality TV are just beyond the pale. They just cannot believe that their mother, the bookworm, does this. So for our anniversary 1 year, they gave us lawn chairs and straw hats and Hawaiian shirts and margarita glasses. And it is mindless and renewing for us, and our other children all know that if you enter the living room on Thursday evening, your hair had better be on fire, because otherwise there is nothing important enough. I mean, if you're throwing up, okay, call us. But we need that space. we've taken to getting up very early in the morning when the weather permits and just sitting out on the deck for 20 minutes having coffee before the kids get up. And we make an effort to talk about things besides children.
Hmm.
You know, we talk about flowers. We're both gardeners and we're both bird watchers. And we talk about politics and just other things besides kids. The sacrifices are huge. Bruce took an early retirement, and I look around and I realize, you know what? We don't have a lot of retirement here. This is because we were incredibly frugal over the years that we could do this and because our wants are very limited. But there are things, we're not going to go on a cruise. That isn't going to happen. We couldn't afford it financially, but more important, we don't have children that we can leave in that kind of a way.
So
losses, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But are there gains? And the gains are more important. We adopted this little girl, and people truly thought we were out of our minds. She's got such special needs. And my husband just turned 60. I'm 53. What were we thinking? Well, what we're thinking is that when she looks up at us and says, "Oh, I love you as big as the whole world." Oh, that's what we were thinking. We are absolute suckers for this child. I have to tell you that we would not have had it any other way.
Yeah.
We thought we could have gotten a convertible or a baby, and we went with the baby.
Now, do you hear from the children that have come through your home?
It is one of the joys of my life that I have ongoing contact with any number of them. I should make a list someday because I'm asked that often. But most of the children that we have moved into adoption, we stay in close contact. That's a process, and you cannot help but have that family turn into your family. You know, these people are part of the family. And those are often children that have been with us years anyway, so they're certainly children of our heart, if not of the family that we choose to have here forever. But kids we care about deeply. And then there are some others, and you know who I really love to hear from? I have four mothers who call me to say, you know, how things are going with them. These are mothers whose children were with me, and then the mothers did their work, got their kids back, and really made dramatic changes in their lives. And I feel so gifted to be able to, you know, it is a gift to me to hear that I had a part to play in this. They did the work, but I was part of that. Oh, huge, huge to me. And every once in a while, I'll have sort of a goofy running into someone that who would expect this. I was in California, now we live way out in Western Mass, doing a book talk, and got a call. The woman who owned the bookstore said, a young woman just called. She said she used to be in foster care at your house, and she's really disappointed she can't be there, but she wanted to know if she could call you here. It was the only way she knew to get in touch with you. And this girl called, and we just had a 20-minute conversation. She was there in design school. She was a terrific kid. We really liked her a lot when she was with us. And how lovely to hear her say, you know, I don't know if I ever said thank you, but I was so grateful. You were kind and generous, and I'd never been in care. I was panic-stricken, and you were so sweet to me and so sweet to my sister, and I'm grateful. Thank you.
Hmm.
Huge to me.
Yeah.
Huge.
We have to wrap up here, but before we do, I'd like you to talk with us about the title of the book. It comes from a very short and direct prayer.
It does. Dear God, be good to me. The sea is so wide and my boat is so small. The Children's Defense League actually uses this at the top of all of their papers, and I think it speaks to exactly what goes on with foster care. This is a wide and scary sea that we all live in, and these children have very small boats. They need God to be good to them, but more importantly, they need us to be good to them. They need us to support them and be rudders for their small boats.
Yeah, they need to get in the boat. Kathy, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
And thank you for having me. This was a wonderful interview.
My pleasure. And to you, happy Mother's Day.
Oh, thank you.
And ahead of Father's Day next month, happy Father's Day to
Bruce. Oh, thank you
so
much. I'll tell him.
Okay, take care.
Thank you.
Our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine has been Kathy Harrison. She is the author of One Small Boat, The Story of a Little Girl Lost, Then Found. The publisher is Tarcher Penguin, a member of the Penguin Group.